This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio. I'm Sandy Billings. Today's show is about the geeks, the nerds, and the dweebs that we are, and those that surround us. We celebrate the intellectuals among us today, those that like the abstract, the technical, the out-of-this-world explorations of science and technology. This show first aired on September 20th, 2008, and I felt it really needed an encore, a geek repeat. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio Show celebrating geeks, nerds, and dweebs. And we celebrate the geekiness in us all. Oh, come on now. You know you've got some of it, too. I'm going to start today's show with the least nerdy of the group. That's Deva Sobel. She's a science writer, and I caught up with her at a science conference where we were surrounded by physicists and astronomers. Now, she hardly qualifies as a geek among them, but in other circles, like family and friends, she's plenty nerdy enough for this show. Deva Sobel is a best-selling author. Her first book, Longitude, is about the search for a way to find longitude at sea. It was a competitive and a difficult endeavor. It took many decades. It stumped the likes of Newton and Galileo. Her book, Longitude, was made into a PBS special. And she followed that book with her second book, Galileo's Daughter, also a bestseller. Deva Sobel spoke with me in June 2008 in St. Louis.
Thank you very much, Deva Sobel, for talking to me today.
Pleasure.
But maybe I'll start with just how you came about to change from freelance writing, shorter article writing type of approach for 20 years or more, and then a whole book. I know that your first one was the SETI once you had a co-author, but then you launched out on your own. How did that progression take place?
I went to a conference. I was really hoping just to write a magazine article, but I'd heard about this Longitude Symposium and tried to get all the magazines I was writing for, just one of them, to agree to let me go to that and write about it. And everybody turned me down. They all thought it sounded boring, weird, and esoteric. But finally, Harvard Magazine agreed. And that event really changed my life. First of all, it was the most interesting scientific meeting I had ever been to. Very exciting, very well organized. And I remember being so excited about it that I was actually writing my article in the car on the way home. I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And then the magazine ran it as the cover story. So Harvard Magazine goes to a very interesting assortment of people around the world. And one of them was a publisher in New York, a small family-owned company. And he read the article and called me the next day that he really saw it as a book. Now, of course, I had never seen it as a book. I could barely get a magazine to accept an article on the subject. So this was the first incredible thing that happened. And he was earnest and serious, and within 15, 20 minutes of talking, I had agreed to this. And it was really a tiny thing. It was a very small advance. And I loved the idea of working on it, but I never thought that that book would go anywhere. And even friends of mine would ask me, what are you working on? And I'd say, oh, I'm writing a book about how the problem of finding longitude at sea was solved. And people would just look down. You know, nobody knew what to say to me. And I remember my son used to ask me all the time, do you really think anybody will read this? And I used to say no. But it's one of these wonderful things. A rare moment in life. I'm working on something I love. I have someone who's completely supportive of the idea. I'm doing this. So then it turned in to phenomenal success. I mean, it was all so unexpected. And during the course of writing that book, I had come on the idea for Galileo's Daughter. So now I had a successful book, so I presented the other idea, and people were quick to say, okay.
Yeah, you probably had people fighting for the book at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what you did with Longitude, though, was you didn't just write a book about, you know, figuring out how to determine longitude at sea. You wrote a story about people's lives.
Right.
And when did that occur to you, that that's what the book was? Was that as early as the conference?
Yeah, because that was the story, that here was this tremendous scientific problem that took centuries to work out. And everybody I'd ever heard of had worked on it, Newton, Galileo. I mean, it's just an extraordinary thing. And then to have this unknown person come out of the north of England and just do it. It's rare in science that you find a human interest story like that. So that was the way to tell that story. I don't see how it could have been otherwise.
Well, let me just back up and go back to Galileo's daughter, and that you found that story while you were researching
Longitude.
The Longitude story. How did that pop up?
I went to the Clockmakers Museum in Pennsylvania to read everything they had about Longitude. And I had very limited time. And there was this wonderful book called The Pulse of Time by Silvio Medini. And it was all about Galileo's work on timekeeping and longitude. And in that book was a letter from the daughter about the clock at the convent and how it was broken, and she was the one who was supposed to fix it. And she had tried, picturing this young woman fixing a clock in early 17th century Italy. I mean, the whole, and she was that person's daughter and could write home and ask him for help. I was overcome by that idea. I just loved it. And her tone of voice in the letter was something startlingly appealing, because she was a nun, but she somehow held herself apart, because I remember the last line of the letter was, "If I don't fix it, these nuns won't let me live," which was really interesting. But I couldn't do anything about it because I was very short, so I just photocopied the letter and I promised myself I'd come back to her later. And then everything I found out just made it more interesting. You know, there were really 124 letters, and they were in Italian. This one was in this book because the author was Italian-American, so he had translated it. And so all of a sudden, I had a reason for having taken Italian in college, which I never had before.
I
felt vindicated.
Yeah, you actually translated the letters
I did,
yourself.
Yes.
So you had to brush up on Italian?
Oh, brush, because I was 30 years out of school. But that's the thing. That was the other great lesson of that book, that the things you learn when you're young, they're still there. The things I learned 10 years ago are gone forever. But when you try to get back something you learned when you were young, it really does come back. And there was an adult ed language program in my town, and the Italian teacher was a retired professor of Italian, and she had grown up Catholic in Italy. I mean, she was everything I needed. And then I asked her if she would work with me as a consultant, and she did, and we had a great time.
So when you're in that in-between stage and you're finishing Longitude and you're discovering Galileo's daughter, you still probably, did you know at that point that you also had a movie on your hands or a television?
No, I didn't know about that till later.
When that came along, did that take more of your time? Were you involved
in
that?
None of my time. They really did it. I was a talking head for 5 or 10 minutes. I mean, I had minimal involvement.
So you just became a little more famous from that.
Right.
How does that affected you? Has that been a surprise?
Oh, yes. It's all been an incredible surprise. But writers manage to stay fairly anonymous. I mean, people don't recognize me on the street, really, which is a good thing.
You've also served your public, though, And so you've responded to the people who are so interested in your work. You published the map book related to longitude because people wanted it, your readers wanted it.
Oh, you mean the illustrated longitude? Yes. Oh, yeah. Actually, that was another brilliant agent idea. I literally had probably 1,000 letters complaining, people saying they really loved the book, but it drove them crazy that there were no pictures. And they were ready to blame the publisher for being a cheapskate, which he really wasn't. I mean, we had this sense, nobody knew how that book would be received, and there was a real fear that if we put in a photo insert, it would look like a textbook. The company, again, it was a small company, so they needed to respond to the interest in the book, but they couldn't over-respond because it would have sunk them. I mean, the number of letters I got from Longitude, now this is really the most unusual thing that happened, because by any measure of sales, Galileo's Daughter was even a bigger success, but did not generate the correspondence that Longitude did. To this day, per year, I get more letters about Longitude than about all my other work combined. I don't know why that is, but it was really startling. And when I worked at the Times, we had this rule of thumb. If you got 3 letters on a story, and that was rare to get even 3 letters, because this was before email. People really had to bother to write you a letter. If you got 3 letters, that meant that 100 people were probably moved to write to you, but were distracted, never got to it. And we got thousands of letters. So there was this constant complaint about the lack of pictures. So the agent said, let's reissue the book. And this was great because it enabled me to thank the organizer of the conference. I made him co-author, and he chose the images and wrote the captions. And we shared the income.
So before you were doing books, were you also finding the human part of the story in some of your articles?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Because that's what it's about, is telling stories.
It really is. And my book about the planets, which I really worked on and really like a lot, just did not catch on the way the others did. And I think that's the reason. It's not a continuous story, and there isn't an identified hero. Mm-hmm. And it's not the same thing.
But that's quite a craft, too, to be able to do. And I think when you think of science writing, you don't think of that. I mean, it may be what many science writers do, but you think of being able to talk about the science and understand the science, not
right.
Understand the people.
Right, yeah.
So you found a way to do that. Do you think it's a natural thing that you happen to have?
I guess so, because I don't think I thought about it.
Yeah.
Often scientists are really interesting, and they have a bad rap, and people think that they're not interesting, and so you often read things that are embarrassing, that will seize on some unusual character trait and make the person look ridiculous. And I really cringe when I see that, because you want to be able to tell those details, but not in a denigrating way. Yeah, there's definitely an impression of perception that if you're a scientist, you don't have a real life. Just so, I don't know how that got started.
Yeah, well, I don't either, but on the fringe of science, since I studied science, I get to claim to be a scientist. I also kind of find that many of us hold it a little bit dear, too. It's kind of like, your friends and family want to say, okay, you're being weird again.
Right.
And you just kind of embrace that.
Exactly. Yeah, I know.
Say, okay.
I wanted my children to go with me on an eclipse cruise some years ago. And so my son said, well, who's going to be on this trip? A bunch of nerds like you? I said, yes.
Yeah.
And he had a great time.
And don't think you're a nerd at all.
Oh, not at all. I mean, I'm barely acceptable.
This is Yin Radio, and you've been listening to my interview with science writer Deva Sobel, author of the bestsellers Longitude and Galileo's Daughter. We'll return to Deva after a short break.
Galileo's head was on the block. The crime was looking up the truth. And as the bombshells of my daily fears explode, I try to trace them to my youth. And then you had to bring up reincarnation over a couple of beers the other night. And now I'm serving time for mistakes made by another in another lifetime. How long till my soul gets it right? Can any human being ever reach that kind of light? I call on the resting soul of Galileo.
And now back to best-selling author Deva Sobel. Here's the second half of our interview.
Let's go back to Galileo's Daughter a little bit. So now you're starting to get into this. I guess at some point you're fairly free, if not free from Longitude.
Oh, well, Longitude freed me because it got me out of debt.
Yeah.
I mean, it really changed my life in major ways.
Did it demand your time, though, to publicize it, or was it self-publicizing?
Well, sometime. You know, it's funny, we didn't even do a book tour because the publisher had no money. So it was word of mouth, it was there. The publisher's serious, active efforts talking to independent bookstores. And see, that wouldn't happen today because those stores are all gone. So that was the kind of book Barnes & Noble didn't want to look at my book until it was on the bestseller list. They never carried it. So it was the creature of the independent bookstores. So I didn't have a lot of publicity events. When the paperback came out, I did. But then, you know, you do that for a week or two and you're done.
So you began working on Galileo's Daughter
right away,
quickly. And that took you to Italy quite a bit?
Yep. 4 times.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to go for a whole summer. I wanted to rent out my house and just take the kids and go. And they said, everybody in the world comes here for the summer. Why would we want to leave?
Yeah.
So we didn't do that.
So where did, who did you use? Who were some of the people you met in this? I heard the story of the nuns.
The nuns,
so
yeah. Well, in Italy, I went to the Museum of the History of Science. And there were great people there. Mara Miniotti and Paolo Galluzzi, who's the director of the museum. And I had gone to, I think the American Academy in Rome sponsored an event just around the time I was starting this book, where they wanted to recreate the banquet where the telescope got its name. They owned the property in Rome where that banquet was held, so they made a big party, and somebody invited me to that. And at the event, I met Francesco Bertola, who was at Padua, which is where Galileo had taught for almost 20 years, and he knew about Galileo's life in Padua. And I would keep having these wonderful coincidences. So I met Bertola at this event in April. Then I went to Italy in July, expressly to see him, but somehow I didn't have his contact information. Something fell apart so that the day I went to the university, I just walked up to the door and nobody was there. And I realized how stupid I'd been. And I heard a motorcycle coming up behind me. It was Francesco Bertola on a Vespa. And he was as shocked to see me as I was to see him. And he said, you know, I haven't been to my office in a month. I had a dentist appointment today, so I was nearby. You know, the...
It makes so you get a little mystical.
I was completely mystical. I kept thinking, I know I'm doing the right thing, because if I weren't doing the right thing, this wouldn't be happening.
Yeah.
So I had... And then he... invited me to his apartment. He had this beautiful apartment in Venice on the Grand Canal. Those are some of the people I spoke to. Owen Gingrich. There were a lot of people in the States who were really helpful. Owen Gingrich, Albert Van Helden. Van Helden was the first person I called because knowing I would have to translate the letters and knowing how difficult that was going to be, I needed some assurance that it was worth doing, that the letters would give me what I was hoping. So he had been a speaker at the Longitude Symposium. I didn't really know him, but I'd heard him speak, and he was very impressive. And he spoke about Galileo. So I called him and said, I'm thinking of doing this. And he was very encouraging and said, I have always wanted to translate those letters. Even if you don't write your book, if you just do that and make them available to students in history of science, women's studies, early modern Europe, whatever, there are a lot of people who'd be interested in reading those letters. And then he said, and when you read them, they'll break your heart. So that was it. I knew it was good.
Knew you had a story.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting a sense of, and not surprised about, is this sense of stick-to-itiveness you have to have for a book.
You sit alone in a room for 5 years.
Yeah, 5 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that what you want to keep doing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually what I like best. And in that sense, I think I really do qualify as a nerd.
I understand that now.
I mean, that is just the best part of it. A lot of people think that if you have success as a writer and you get to go on book tour, that that's the pinnacle. But that is not the pinnacle. You know, the pinnacle happens in those moments when you're alone and you finally get it. Or, you know, you realize that you really do have a story and what you're writing is actually good.
Oh, yes, translating the letters and publishing those.
Well, this
was done as a gift.
Yes. Well, first I had all the letters in the book because I felt it was a fragmentary record. We shouldn't fragment it further by publishing only some of them. And I loved them all. But the inclusion of all the letters forced the book into a strange shape because the letters cover only 10 years. So I was constantly having to flash back to tell the earlier parts of Galileo's story. And most of the letters occur during the trial because he was far away and she would write these long letters telling him everything that was happening at home. And so when I turned in the manuscript, the editor, and it's the same editor I had for Longitude, this was very hard for him to have to tell me that the book just did not work because he knew how hard I had worked on this. And he said, you know, there are just too many letters, and they're really not interesting, not all of them. And especially during the trial, that action is so dramatic, and then it's constantly interrupted. So he said, when I was reading the manuscript, I started skipping over the letters. It was one of those moments, I just put my head down the table, cried. I couldn't believe it was that bad. I mean, I knew the book wasn't really there yet, but I wasn't expecting that. And at first I thought it was just a guy thing, that he didn't really. So we showed it to a woman editor, Casey Cole. I think she was at Discover then. And she read it. She said, he's right. So then he suggested that we each pick the 25 letters that we thought were the best ones. And our lists agreed in all but one. So that was also another validation that I really should listen to him. And then I just had to rewrite it entirely because I just told the whole early part of his life. Her first letter doesn't appear till, I don't know, page 80 or 90 or something like that. So it was a very different. Actually, the first letter appears on page 1. He said, start with one of them, but then go back and bring us up to her. So you do get a feel for her right away, but then it's more of a...
The story is about him.
Right, and that was always the point.
But it's as seen through her eyes.
Right, and that was the new thing about Galileo that I had to say, that he actually was serious about being Catholic, which I thought was a fascinating aspect of him that I had not seen anybody acknowledge. And again, being Jewish, I didn't have any case to make about it. I just thought he had been misrepresented. And it was far more interesting to have a person who really is a believing Catholic discovering these things and coming to these conclusions that are at odds with the church position. I mean, that was really a clash for him and for her. I mean, I expected that to come out more. But I don't think she was disturbed by it as much as I expected. No, that was a surprise as I read the letters, that she just always thought he was fabulous.
Yeah.
Whatever he did.
We all need people like that in our lives.
Yeah. The unconditional love.
Yes.
And, you know, not everybody agrees with me. I had Mario Biagioli at Harvard. He's another very well-known Galileo scholar. And he thinks that that Galileo was just awful, that he dumped the girls in the convent and it was a terrible failing, and that the reason she expresses all this love is just desperation, begging for attention. But, we have a different opinion.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I would like to talk just a little bit about your play.
Sure.
And it sounds like you've had some readings.
I've had three readings. Not workshops,
okay,
but readings, where the actors receive the script a day or two before. I don't know that all of them actually read it a day or two before. Some of them seem to be reading it on the spot, but they, professional actors are a pretty terrific group. And so I've gotten to listen to it, which is very different from reading it over. And a play needs that. And actually, at my first reading, I almost didn't know what to make of the experience of hearing it. But it's come far. It has far to go, but it has come far.
This is your first attempt at writing a play.
Yeah.
It's about Copernicus.
Yes.
And this must be another story about the person.
Oh, there's a great story, yeah, to Copernicus. And he's a really mysterious character because there's so little evidence of any kind about him that you really do have to make it up.
So this is
that's
fictionalized
why.
Account.
Yeah. Yeah.
But based
there's
on
a no, it's based on the true story. And when I publish the play, which I will do with my wonderful publisher, Walker, we will include a long essay about what the play does versus what's actually known, and there'll be a timeline of the actual historical events and enough to put it into perspective, because I really see this play as something for college level theater groups, and that it could be part of an interdisciplinary science program, or if there's a science conference on campus, the theater department could do the play, there could be discussion. I love visiting colleges. That's my favorite thing to do now.
You travel so much.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I assume that while being alone in your room may be the pinnacle of success, the travel must be pretty good too.
It is. It is. And a lot of it is fun. A lot of it is just really just too much traveling. Because, of course, you stop working what you're working on. And it takes a fair amount of preparation to go talk to a group of college students for 2 or 3 days.
I would say any real nerd doesn't want to stop working on what they're working
right.
on. So maybe
right.
you do fit
but
the
sometimes,
definition a little
yeah.
bit.
But sometimes it's good mm-hmm. to get away, have a forced break because you shake up your thoughts and come back and maybe see it in a better light.
Have you already discovered in the process of Galileo's Daughter or the Copernicus play, have you discovered that next project? Is it tickling at your mind?
No. No, and I'm really sad about that. Mm-hmm. Oh, actually, I have another play idea. But I am struggling so with this play that I don't know. That's what I'd really like to do. I'd like to be able to get this play to where I think it really works. If I get to that, and you see, you can't make a living writing plays. That's my real problem now. I've run through all the money. So I have to be the responsible adult and go back to doing what will actually earn money. So I'm writing articles again. I've had a couple of grants. I might try to get another one, but to write a play, it's an expensive hobby, is what it is.
Well, I look forward to seeing it.
Well, I hope that will happen.
Well, thank you very much.
This
I really
was fun.
Appreciate the time.
Sure.
And I look forward to reading everything you put out.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was science writer Dava Sobel, best-selling author of the books Longitude and Galileo's Daughter. And you can find more about Dava Sobel at davasobel.com. That's DAVASOBEL.com.
Into a starry sky upon Jupiter. Those cold moons are making their weary rounds. Did he know that the Pope would claim that he ran with Lucifer? And a prison cell would be where he lay his head down. Was he wearing a thorny crown when he plotted the motion of planets? Was Mercury and retrograde? But he found the truth when a lie was what was and the judges asked him pointedly, he was a tremble in the day. The Galileo Brave. The Galileo Brave.
This is Yin Radio with an encore of our September 20th, 2008 show about geeks, nerds, and dweebs. It's a geek repeat. A chemical engineer, a mechanical engineer, and an agricultural engineer walk into the exhibit hall and... No, it's not a joke. And if it was, most of us wouldn't even get the punchline anyway. But at the University of Idaho, each spring, these engineering students... All flavors, mechanical, electrical, civil, chemical, environmental, computer, agricultural. They do walk into the same room just before they graduate, and they do a professional quality show of their senior design projects. That's where installment number 2 comes from. 4 engineering students, most of them on the verge of graduating, showed off their projects last year and talked about their plans for the future with Karen Raffo. Here's Karen's report from the 2008 Idaho Engineering Expo.
Okay, can you tell me? Melissa Pikarski.
And you're a student here?
Yes, I'm. This is my 3rd year of school, but I'm a sophomore in the chemical engineering department.
Okay.
Yeah.
And can you tell me about your project?
Basically, we make these cars for a competition for the American Institute of Chemical Engineers. Every year they have a huge conference, about 7,000 people come. Part of the conference is to race these cars, well, not really race, just compete them. All the cars have to run off of an alternate fuel source, either biological or chemical. They all have to have a timing mechanism to start and stop them because we can't use like a remote control or anything to control starting, stopping, or steering. So, we have 2 hydrogen fuel cell cars, and we have a biological battery car here in the middle. That car on the end has a timing mechanism of a piston switch, and the solution for it is water and Alka-Seltzer. When they mix, it produces carbon dioxide, which pushes the piston up, hitting the button on the switch, and that closes the circuit, allowing the car to go. Once the piston falls, then the circuit opens again and the car will stop. So at the competition, they'll tell you a distance between 50 and 100 feet and a load between 0 and 500 grams about an hour before the competition. So what all of this is about, you spend the whole semester testing in order to get some kind of fitted trend line like this so that you know how much stuff you need to put into your timing reaction to get to that distance as accurate as possible, because the person closest to the line wins. Regionals is actually tomorrow for these, but I've been on the team for 3 years, and we've been to regionals twice, nationals twice also. So. We've always gotten first at regionals in the history of the U of I's car team, and we got 10th, 9th, and 7th at nationals in the past. Yeah, no problem. I really want to research alternate energy in some way. Yeah, no problem.
Can you go ahead and give me your name?
My name is Brandy Holmes.
Okay. And you're a student of engineering?
Yes, I'm a mechanical engineer.
Okay. Can you tell me about your project?
Okay. A little bit of background about our project is that NASA sends a lot of probes to Mars and Venus. We all know this. And on these probes are heat shields. We know this too. NASA doesn't get these heat shields back, and they need to know how well their heat shields perform, if they're on the verge of blowing up or whatever. And so they incorporate a lot of sensors in these heat shields. And these heat shields let us monitor the heat shield performance, like I said. And then we also learn a lot about the atmosphere through this. And the problem is that they have like hundreds of these sensors throughout the heat shield, and each sensor has a wire going back to the probe. And so before you eject the heat shield, you have to cut all these wires. If you don't, then you kind of have a rover in a box, and it doesn't do much. And the other problem is that it weighs a lot. They have a new probe going to Mars in the next year. It's called the Mars Science Laboratory. It's a rover about the size of a Mini Cooper. And for the entire payload that's going to Mars, about 30% of that mass is wires from this system. And so it's a serious amount of weight.
Yeah.
And so they've come to us at University of Idaho, and last year they commissioned a senior design team to start designing and researching a wireless sensor system. Last year they did a great job. They got a prototype. Our job this year was to expand that into a sensor array, throw in some more sensors. We do pressure and temperature. Last year they only had temperature. And we did a lot of testing. We went down to NASA Ames and X-Jet. They have a plasma torch that simulates reentry conditions. We had some shuttle tiles that we integrated our product with and tested it there. We got a lot of really positive results. It worked great. It was awesome. And then another goal of our project is to make our system very versatile. We want it expandable, robust, so it doesn't have to always fly in the same sort of mission. It can fly like in atmosphere if we want to take data on some sort of mission. And so what we did is we incorporated our product into a high altitude scientific weather balloon. There's a group on campus that does these every semester or so. They're called VAST. And so we threw our sensor arrays in there with our receiver node, and we sent it up, and it all looks great. It was a beautiful day and everything. The lift on the balloon was a bit low, and so it got caught in the jet stream, and it traveled about twice as far as it should have over land, and it landed in this densely wooded, snowed-in area that you can't get to except on foot with 4 feet of snow. And so it spent a couple nights out in the woods while we kind of figured out how to get to it. And there's a whole bunch of locals, and they're like, stay off our property or you might get shot. And so it was a little bit of an adventure to get to. But so it did take a couple days to get to it. And in that time, our batteries had died. And so when we're recording this data on a flash drive, and if the power gets interrupted, the flash drive freaks out, it resets, and converts all of our data into corrupted packets. So we actually didn't get any data from the flight, but it was a great learning experience, and we know exactly what went wrong, and it's a really easy way to fix it. We just have to incorporate an off switch. And so that's our project. It's really cool. There's room for expansion in the future. We have a gal who's looking to come here for her master's work, and she's thinking on taking it up for her thesis and continuing on the studies. That's my spiel I've been doing all day.
Good.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Cool.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Yeah, good luck with everything. Can you tell me your name, please?
My name's Kate Boudreau. Yeah, I'm a senior mechanical engineering student, ready to graduate.
Yeah. Yep. Where are you from?
Portland.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to go back to Portland?
I think so, for a couple weeks to visit my family, and then I got a job offer from a place in Alaska, so I'll probably go up there.
What's the offer?
The offer is to do fluid calculations for the pipeline. So I'd be working out on the North Slope a little bit and then back in Anchorage. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you tell me about your project?
Sure. Well, we were commissioned by a company called Key Technology in Walla Walla, Washington, and they design shaker beds for food processing. And so our job was to redesign the gate that directs food to go one way or another, because right now the gate that they have isn't very sanitary. It clogs up a lot with food and grows bacteria. And so we came up with a design that uses a synthetic rubber and deforms, and that's the gate. And the reason for using that is that there's no places for food to hide because it's all in contact with the food all the time, and it just deforms to redirect the food different ways. Yeah. So this is the old gate right there. It used to slide back and forth. Yeah. And we also designed this testing bed for us to test food on, and it's got a concentric weight spinning around a motor which shakes the whole bed, and it's on four springs. And when it's bolted to the ground, then the bed shakes and we can test whether the food flows properly.
Will you be working with anything like this in your new job?
Well, I might have to do... To design this bed, we had to do lots of calculations with vibrations to make sure that it didn't, like, propagate into the floor, and so we had to use the right springs and all of that. And so I might have to do a little bit of that to make sure there's no rattling in the pipeline, like if you get flow going in too fast, it'll create a rattle all down the pipeline. So I might have to do a little bit of calculation that way.
Okay.
But I probably won't be working with food very much in my new job. So it's going to be a little bit of a change. Yeah.
Thank you. It's very interesting.
Yeah, no problem. Nice to meet you.
You too. Okay, can you give me your name?
My name is Shannon Lynn Strittmatter.
And you're an engineering student.
Yes, I am a senior engineer. It's actually an agricultural engineer.
Do you have a job lined up?
I do. As soon as I graduate, I'm moving and starting a career with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, nicknamed the NRCS. It's nationwide, and I'm working 2 hours north of Seattle in Mount Vernon. So.
All right. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well,
our senior design team is called Terra Creations. We are automating a bagging system for Potting Shed Creations. They're out of Troy. And right now they have a couple people that fill up small Ziploc baggies with soil. And so what we're doing is, because of the different moisture contents, we actually designed a hopper and an auger that's inside and a vibratory feeder that fits underneath the hopper so that we can push the soil through the auger and actually have it where it can... come through the vibratory feeder and fill up a bag so that they're not over a wheelbarrow scooping it into a Ziploc baggie. It's an automated system. A little publicity for them, but they Potting Shed Creations is from Troy, as I stated. They are available on the internet at pottingshedcreations.com, and they are available at the co-op. They're really nice people over there, so if you ever need to, they're at the old elementary school in Troy. Just go ahead and stop by. They're really friendly, so... engineering is great, of course. Being a female engineer, it's awesome. My major is actually 80% female, which is really odd. Most engineering majors are 10% female, 10 to 15%, and if you can make it through it and be a female engineer, it's way worth it.
That was Karen Raffo talking with Idaho engineering students. The reporter, Karen Raffo, graduated in May 2008 along with most of the engineers that she interviewed. Karen was interning with Yin Radio when she filed that report.
And then they had the nerve to say, what would you like to be? I says, I'm going to be an engineer. No, you only have to learn to be a lady. The duty isn't yours for to try to run the world. An engineer could never have a baby. Remember, dear, that you're a girl.
Installment number 3 is a collection of 3 stories of women who are deeply passionate about the heavens, and they've made careers of it. They all are PhD astronomers and physicists. They work in very different applications, but all in astrospacey geeky endeavors. The first, Amy Lowe, builds spacecraft for observations and explorations. The second, Katie Garmany, uses major telescopes around the world, and she once ran the biosphere, the enclosed environment where people tried to live with their own exhalations and waste, just like a spacecraft, but it was on Earth. And the last is Barb Mattson, who studies black holes. Fairly exotic work. Fairly impressive women. Okay, I'm talking to Amy Lowe with Northrop Grumman Corporation. Thanks for talking to me, Amy. Tell me, why is Northrop here? What do you do that's astronomy?
We're actually the builders of a lot of these astronomical explorers. For example, right now we're the prime contractor on a telescope called the James Webb Space Telescope. It's a telescope that's supposed to look in the near and far infrared band of the electromagnetic spectrum. And it's supposed to do things like explore the very early universe, look at the very first stars. And what we do at Northrop is we actually build the spacecraft. We're known as a prime contractor. And that's someone who puts the spacecraft together, puts the design together, pulls in all of the different various people that are needed to do this work. So you can imagine something like JWST is extremely complicated. You've got the 6.5-meter primary mirror, which is very large. And what you need is you need a whole group, hundreds of people, if not thousands, to put this together. And we act as sort of the chef. So we pull all the ingredients together, and we also perform some of the work ourselves.
And this is one that you have underway right now.
Yes.
I also saw Chandra, the Compton Gamma Ray, the Lunar Crater. That was one that really caught my attention.
Yeah, LCROSS is something that we're building right now. In fact, LCROSS stands for Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing is it's sort of a novel mission. Usually in a launch on a rocket, you stick, you know, your satellite on top of a rocket, you fire the rocket, and you blow everything up into space, and right. Then they get detached and they go. Now, in the case of of a satellite known as a lunar reconnaissance orbiter, there was excess capacity, meaning they could carry a lot more mass than just was on LRO, lunar reconnaissance orbiter. So they thought it would be great if we could tag another mission with LRO. And so this is the piggyback that's okay. Riding along with LRO. And what LCROSS is going to do is it's going to take this, what's known as an upper stage. This holds all the fuel. Now what LCROSS is going to do is carry the empty, spent shell of this thing, this long tube, carry it to the moon, aim itself at a crater in the south pole of the moon, let go of this guy, let go of the big launch, the upper stage, smack it into the crater. And what we're trying to do is create a plume and this little dude here, the actual experiment itself, the actual satellite, is going to fly through that plume and figure out what's in that crater.
So it's going to sample that moon, that lunar material, because it's been thrown up in the...
Exactly.
Not in the air, but
exactly.
It's been thrown up.
Near the surface of the moon, exactly. And so the idea is what we're trying to do is get what's known as in situ on the actual place measurement of, is there water? We can do all kinds of remote sensing, you know, we can take a picture of the moon, we can analyze the spectrum, but... You know, gosh darn it, we need that actual measurement of how much water is there.
What aspects are you involved in, other than telling me about it?
Myself, personally, I am in what's known as business development. And so that is where we take the first ideas, come up with the initial concepts. And so my job would be, for example, to do the initial concepts for LCROSS, to do the initial concepts for JWST.
So that must mean, I'm guessing, that you have to kind of have the broader view of a variety of sciences and technologies.
Yes, you need to understand what the community needs. And in my particular field, my concentration is on the astronomy community because I have a background in astronomy. So I got my PhD at UCLA in astronomy.
Does that mean that you're officially still a geek?
Yeah, I think so. I think you kind of have to be a geek to do all of this stuff. It's one of these things where it's larger than life and it's all-consuming, and you know, you have to like it to do it. And to do well in it, I think you have to love it.
Yeah.
So, okay, it's difficult not to love, you know? I mean, how cool is this? You know, we're crashing something into the moon. Wow.
Yeah. Good. Well, thanks very much,
no
Amy.
Problem.
I appreciate it.
No problem.
So I'm with Katie Garmany with NOAO. Tell me about NOAO first.
Well, NOAO stands for National Optical Astronomy Observatory, and many people who know something about astronomy will know it better as Kitt Peak National Observatory, which was the name under which it started many years ago, but it now encompasses telescopes in the northern and southern hemisphere and Hawaii as well. So now we are NOAO.
What's your role right now, Katie?
Well, although I started my career as a research astronomer, I now do mostly education and outreach, although I still dabble a little bit in research. So primarily I run a national program for high school teachers. It's fairly high-end, but it's for teachers who are already including astronomy in their curriculum, generally physics and chemistry and so forth, but they want to bring high-end projects to their students. So we give these teachers first an online course to kind of bring them up to speed, because most people don't have too much of an astronomy background. Then in June they come out to Kitt Peak, spend 10 days with us, get up to speed, and we take all 18 teachers up to the observatory, and they spend four nights up there getting to observe on four different telescopes, including one that's 2 meters in diameter, which is a big telescope by most standards. So then they take these projects, sort of directed research projects, back to their classroom and use them at different levels. It might be just a class project, but for the students who want to really go on and do something advanced, they can take off. And as a matter of fact, a student of one of our teachers this year has actually won one of the second prizes at the Intel Science and Engineering Fair that just took place in Atlanta. So very pleased with that.
Well, tell me a little bit about your research that you used to do and maybe still dabble in just a little bit, and I'm curious about the transition that you made.
Well, my research area has always been hot stars. I'm interested in very massive hot stars, and for many years I worked on questions like how do they evolve, these stars lose a lot of mass. So I did a lot of spectroscopic studies of how these stars lose mass. Memberships in clusters, how many of these very massive stars exist, what we call the initial mass function, which is just a representation of how many stars in each mass bin you would find if you could go out and count. So I did a lot of work in the southern hemisphere looking at our sister nearby galaxies, the Magellanic Clouds, and got to observe in the southern hemisphere to do that. When I morphed into education, there wasn't an immediately direct correlation there, but now I'm finding that one of the projects that we give our teachers to work on is to look at young open clusters and learn how to take the data and plot what is basically what we call an HR diagram or a color magnitude diagram, which is sort of the standard for all stars. It tells us not only the distance of the stars in the cluster, but we then use that to study evolution of the stars.
Before I let you go, tell me just a little bit more about the observatories, or observatory, and we've talked about the educational use, but I assume the primary use is for researchers and probably competitive.
Very much so. This is the National Observatory, which means that any astronomer in the United States, and indeed foreign astronomers as well, apply for time. Twice a year, there's an open competition in which they apply for time. The bigger telescopes, and even the smaller ones, are way oversubscribed. They get to come to Kitt Peak. Kitt Peak, which is near Tucson, actually has 23 telescopes on the mountain. And so we have people coming through regularly to observe on these telescopes. And most of what NOAO does is not education. That's a small component of it. It's development of instruments and telescopes, because, of course, the telescope is important, but the instrument attached to the telescope is what really counts. And that's what we do a lot of, is developing the instruments to go on these big telescopes these days, not only for Kitt Peak, but also for Cerro Tololo in Chile and the Gemini telescopes.
Do you get to visit some of those places still?
I do sometimes. Actually, I was down in Chile in January on one of the few research projects I'm still working on, so I have gotten down to see those, and people from the southern hemisphere come up. So I
would think that would be especially a nice little perk.
Oh, it absolutely is, yes. I spent New Year's Eve down in Chile observing on a 6.5-meter telescope, and that was an absolute kick. That was wonderful.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Katie.
I'm talking to Barb Mattson with NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center.
Mm-hmm.
That's in
Greenbelt, Maryland, near Washington, D.C.
Tell me what your booth is about first.
Okay, the booth is about Constellation X. It's a planned X-ray mission. It's kind of a follow-on to Chandra. Our goal here, Chandra's goal was to do magnificent images. And our goal is to take a next step and do magnificent spectroscopy, which is basically breaking light down into its constituent wavelengths or colors. A lot of people are used to seeing like a rainbow. That's the idea here, except in X-rays, which our eyes can't see. And so from that, we can tell different things about black holes. We can look at galaxies, clusters of galaxies.
I'm assuming you're looking at kind of specific objects that have to be higher energy that to be of interest in X-ray.
Yes, they have to be extremely high energy, very hot regions. Often they are they're often very violent places in the universe. And so I happen to study black holes. Those capture the imagination of pretty much everybody. And what you see when you're looking at a black hole, there's a lot going on. Specifically in the centers of galaxies is where I look. And there's an accretion disk. There's material that is swirling into that black hole, getting, I hate the word, but sucked in, if you will. And as it's getting pulled in, it's emitting energy because it's getting accelerated, it's running into other stuff, and you see the X-rays from that. In addition, there are sometimes jets coming out.
Do you have this telescope specced out? What stage is it in?
It's basically in technology development, and so the current design may not be the design that flies, and in fact probably won't be the design that flies. They're currently looking at another configuration for this.
What is the estimated time that it's going to go up?
Currently we're hoping for about 2018 for a time frame. That all depends on funding.
I don't have any other questions unless there's something else you need me to make sure the world knows.
I think I'm happy.
Are you, and does that mean you're happy doing what you're doing too?
Yes. Yeah, I'm happy doing what I'm doing. I'm currently looking for a job, but yeah. Not because of the mission, actually, just because I just finished my PhD and looking for my next step.
What did you tell people? So you just finished your PhD?
I did. I just finished my PhD in April. I've graduated a week and a half ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm looking at gearing my career into education and public outreach. So some of it may be in the line of research and looking at those black holes that we were talking about, but also trying to get astronomy into the hands of the public, whether that's teachers, the general public, science centers, after school.
Yeah. Well, best of luck, Dr. Barb Mattson.
Thank you very much.
This has been Geek Repeat on Yin Radio. I'm wrapping it up with a bit of some fun electronic piece. It's called Wonder Machines by Intercontinental Music Lab.
Sound system one built in number 20 flying machines. This is their story and his.
The giant scar made from Japanese silk. I crash into trees and fly up to the milk. Wider gas here, rotary fan. I crash into trees, this time I cut my knees. Shorter figure, lamp gas inside. Around the Eiffel Tower, it's lifting my pride. Out of my basket, I straddle a bike. Like a witch in a broom, I can fly where I like.
You can listen to past shows and podcast this show and sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. Please drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at v as in voice, p as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and it's heard on the best community radio stations in the country. This show is produced by Karen Raffo and Sandy Billings. Opening music is Smell of the Sea by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, the executive producer and host, and I'm glad you joined me.